Cool. Good morning. Y'all can hear me? Okay. As I was sitting in back, I was reflecting on a few things, and that story always comes to mind. I so appreciate that you tell it every time, because that's how I ended up here. Like, I don't have family here. I did not attend this church, and you all just claim me, and I love it. But as I was sitting in back, I was thinking, I travel to churches and kind of pop in and out when I'm in the States, but if I could give an award, like, the men in this church are wearing the coolest shirts. Like, I've seen pineapples, hot sauce, like, waves, Hawaiian vibe, surfers. So, well done. Somebody even showed me an Amer shirt this morning, and I was like, amazing. The other thing is, at my church in Nairobi, where I live, missionaries love to make babies, and the church is, like, 50% children. And we keep the kids in all the way up until the sermon as well. And we call it a pamoja service, which in Swahili means together, like we are all together. And so having your kids in service today actually brings me great comfort, because I'm used to children just running around and enjoying church together. That's just, it's what we do. So I brought some pictures, and I'll just go ahead and talk through them. This was a flight up in Core, and I don't normally wear those beads when flying. It's a bit gaudy, but the women gifted them to me, and you're supposed to wear them if you're married, and I was like, I'm not married, and they're like, in hope, and I was like, okay, I don't think you know my prospects, but... fine, but it made for this really cool picture. So I use it now. So I'm a pilot with Africa Inland Mission, technically with AIM Air. So Africa Inland Mission, we're a mission organization all across the continent of Africa, south to north, including creative access locations. And we also do diaspora ministries. So we have teams in the US, in Canada, and in Europe that are reaching Africans that have moved and migrated. AIM Air is the aviation division of Africa Inland Mission. So we are based in Nairobi, but we operate in Nairobi, Uganda, South Sudan, sometimes Tanzania, DRC, Congo, kind of like the whole pocket of East Africa. If you go to the next slide, this is my house. I thought to throw a picture up there because people often think I live in a hut. I don't live in a hut. Nairobi is quite modern. When I overnight, I am often in huts and more rural locations, but this is my house in Nairobi. It's a townhouse. It's a fully Kenyan subdivision, 71 houses, and kind of makes a figure eight. You can walk through it, around it. The inside looks like a traditional American home. I just snapped this picture one day when I was reading for school. I'm a student. I am doing doctoral studies through Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, so shout out to California. And so I just thought, let me take a picture to show you what my normal Saturday morning is like, usually doing schoolwork with a cup of coffee in my home with the garden. So you can go to the next one. This is the market right down the street from my house. They dead fried fish is a thing. They love it. And you can buy fresh fruit and vegetables. We live on the equator, so temperature-wise, 65 to 85 degrees year-round. Really nice. And that means we're kind of in the banana belt, so fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, very vibrant, and very inexpensive. So like a pineapple would be $1.50, maybe. A tomato, 10 cents a piece. Avocado, 5 to 10 cents a piece. Mangoes during... yeah. Mangoes during mango season, 10 cents a piece. Just like beautiful fresh fruit and vegetables. So I love kind of walking down to the market and just buying some stuff and putting it in my fridge for the week. Next one. I keep gnomes in my yard. Fun fact about me, not anything spiritual, but I love a good gnome. Once I was out on home leave in the States and my neighbors gnomed me. They added a gnome to my yard and I realized it right away. But I love a good gnome. The picture on this side is the Arboretum. So in Nairobi, not a lot of safe spaces to walk and run. Big, big, big city. Bustling, high crime. not a lot of trails, but there is a place called the Arboretum, and I will often go out on Saturday mornings and just walk 6 or 7 miles and just get some fresh air and just move my body a little bit. It helps me to decompress, and this is one of the places where I can do that. So I deeply appreciate that kind of landscape. We can go to the next one. I put a map up so that you could see. So Kenya is the country in green. No, that's okay. Yeah. We have a second base in Uganda, kind of the tip. Oh, we're kind of the left top quadrant of Uganda, right by DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and South Sudan. But AMER's bread and butter, where we do most of our flying, Kenya, Uganda, South Sudan. We do fly into CAR, and we do fly into DRC. We're often overflying DRC to get into CAR. You can see those two countries are not colored in on the map. We're in Tanzania on occasion, but not very often. We do not have legal permissions to go into Sudan or Ethiopia or Somalia. So we're East Africa, but not kind of the northern side of it. Can go forward. This is a picture of our terrain. So it's quite mountainous. We've got everything from like beautiful safari plains and lakes to quite big mountains, taller than what our planes can fly. So we go around them, not into them. But this is what a normal aeronautical navigation chart looks like. Quite high. And then I put this picture in. This is what looking our hangar outward looks like. So this is on our ramp. If you were standing back in the middle of our hangar, this is what you would see. The plane, the larger plane on the right, that is one of our Cessna Caravan aircraft. It's a turbine plane. It seats 14. We have three of them. And then the plane on the left is a Cessna 206. It's turbine, it seats six people, and we have three of those as well. So we're a fleet of six, a team of 15 pilots, and we're about 7 or 8 mechanics. AMER as a whole, we're about 35 families, and then we have national staff that work with us as well, which takes us up to about 60 people. So we're quite a large team for the scope of work that we do. I can go forward one. Oh, I put a video in. There's no sound with it, so you're not missing anything. But this would be up in Kor in northern Kenya. The shed to the left that you see is where we store our fuel. We drive it by road. And most of our runways are this unimproved rock, gravel type of surface. You can see it was windy. Windsocks blow in. And then in this video, I'm just taxiing back to turn around and take off in this direction. So I put it in so that you could have a visual of the types of places that we fly and the different landscapes that we operate in. So I've been with AMER now since 2014, so almost 10 years. I've been flying for 20 years. I just ran the math on that. I'm 36. About to turn 37. I started flying when I was 17. But because I've been at AMER for so long now, most of my training, I do still do operational flying where we're out upcountry. I'm overnighting. But a good bulk of my flying is teaching and training our new pilots. So almost all of my flying is to crew now because I'm training somebody. I'm sitting right seat and I'm training them in the left seat. So that's the picture that you see here. I was training one of our new caravan pilots on the left. And this is kind of a cool photo because the outside picture that you see is us in the cockpit at the same. So we were in the air on this picture, but then we were taking off on that. And that was into Ngurunet, where we have a missionary family that stays there. So we do quite a bit of two crew training. Like when you land in Nairobi, if you're a pilot, you work with me for almost a year before you're released to fly solo by yourself. I have a flight instructor background, so I love teaching and training, and it's really fitting for me. And I think the guys, I hope they appreciate it as well. But so most of my flying these days is to crew. Like I said, I still do operational flying. So this would have just been a picture up in northern Kenya. we will often go and spend the night with the people that we're flying, and we kind of bounce around with them for a few days. That's quite common. So we stay in rural locations with them. It helps to save money, which is why we stay. So this is a typical picture of what it would look like after I've landed and put the plane to bed for the night, and then we would head off into the village and go from there. I think I have two stories for you guys. So just as a refresher, I know I tell you this every time, so if you have heard it, bear with me. But Africa Inland Mission, the purpose of the organization is to build Christ-centered churches among all African peoples with priority for the unreached. So what that means is, like, within this church, let's say we were considered an unreached people group, that doesn't have anything to do with where you're at in the world and proximity and road access, but it has to do with spiritual access to the gospel. So if we were an unreached people group, a tribe living together, unreached would mean that less than 2% of us know who Jesus is. Anything over 2% would be considered a reached people group. So in this context, that would mean, like, you would be reached if these three people knew Christ. That's the threshold from reached to unreached. So AIM is working with people that are primarily unreached. And then we are also working with people, bear with me for one other term, who are unengaged, which means they're unreached. They don't have a 2% of believers in that tribal community. And unengaged, meaning they have nobody to tell them. So AIM is sending teams of people into tribal communities where they are unreached, and then these teams live with them, so they become engaged. They go from unengaged to engaged. They now have somebody that can tell them about the gospel, somebody that can introduce them to Jesus. So that is why we operate aircraft, because as you might imagine, to get to these tribes and people groups, now you have logistical challenges, and you need to fly supplies, you need to fly people in and out, you have difficulty with road access, it might be hostile, you might have political instability. So that's where the aircraft component piece comes into play. I was up just a few weeks ago in this location. This is in South Sudan, kind of far north, like right against the Nile River. And I had never been here before. So a lot of people say, like, do you fly into every place first before you carry passengers? No. runways are all kind of the same. But it was my first time being here. This place is called Malakal. And I had heard a little bit about Malakal because they had a war. South Sudan had a big war in 2013. And Malakal was kind of torn up from the war. But I'd never been there, so I was like, be interesting to check it out and see what it's like. And as you can see, the river, like the town is just right up against the river. And when we were flying in, we flew over this camp, which I thought was a refugee camp. And it turns out it was not. There is a refugee camp in Malakal. But this was an IDP camp, which stands for Internally Displaced Persons. So this camp that you see a picture of is all like refugees from the country of South Sudan being housed in this camp in South Sudan. Does that make sense? So it's people from within the country that are basically displaced or refugees from within their own country. So they're not fleeing to another country. They're just staying where they are. On the other side of this picture was a proper refugee camp, and that was having refugees from Sudan. And they had walked from Sudan and were seeking refuge in South Sudan. If you go to the next slide, what made this place interesting, and I'll be honest, I'm still processing a little bit about what it was like, because I've never been to a spot quite like this. Typically, when a town is destroyed by war or strife, what they do is they move slightly next door to the rubble. Like, they take what is good remaining and they just slide down like a half mile, and then they build again. In this case, they did not. They decided to live in the rubble. And so that's what you see here. The war was now 12 years ago. And this is just what it looks like driving down the streets of Malakal. I've never been in a spot quite like that before. Like, I've never seen a people that chose to stay in the location without sliding, or I've never seen a people that found the land or the spot to be more valuable than just moving. And then the complexities of the IDP camp and then the refugee camp, and yet the community in itself is just struggling to maintain. If you go to the next slide, the picture on this side, what you see is just kind of a road heading to the river. So their primary source of nutrition is fish off the Nile. And you see mamas and kids kind of carrying fish on their head and baskets. But this other picture, I don't want to leave you with just a gloomy perspective and view of Malakal, but is a set of pastors. So the church is in existence there, and it is growing, and it is expanding, and there are believers. And so we were privileged to attend a church service and just to hear from them and to get to pray with them and to encourage them. And this was in the morning. The next day we had spent the night. You can see in the background some huts. That's where we had slept. And these pastors just brought some tea out and just shared with us, and we just got to hear their stories and just pray together and encourage them. And for me, that was encouraging to know that even in places that are struggling and continuing to struggle with instability, that God is still working and the church is still growing and people are still accepting the Lord, and that hope is very much alive and present. It may not look like what I expect it to look like, but God is still moving and still working. And so to me, that's encouraging. I will tell another story before we go on to the next slide. You don't hear a lot about what's going on in South Sudan and the war, but South Sudan is like in a perpetual civil war. Like, they just always will be. And I think they will be until the Lord comes. It is just a place of incredible strife and tension and conflict. And we had gotten, I was on a flight like in Nairobi. I was at our main airport, and I showed up to work that day, and I was expecting to fly a group of Bible translators up to northern Kenya. They were running like a conference of sorts, and they were doing this literacy training with other rural pastors in northern Kenya. Really great project. I was really excited about it, and I was pumped. And you're like, what does this have to do with South Sudan? It will connect in just a second. But I showed up to the airport that morning, and I was told we were going to have like 1,000 kilos, so like 2,000 pounds of audio Bibles. And that's why we needed the bigger caravan. And I'm like, this is going to be great. Like, I'm going to get to watch like this pastor training going on. Like, pastors are going to train other pastors in northern Kenya. This sounds fantastic. But I show up to work, and I'm not joking, there's like 6 boxes of audio Bibles. And I was mad. Like, I was like, are you kidding me? Like, why are we chartering this big aircraft when there's just a few boxes of audio Bibles? Like, where did the communication break down? And then it turns out there's only a couple of pastors that we were flying up there. And I thought we would have like a plane full of pastors. And I was like, what is going on? I got so feisty that I started to look for commercial options for them. Like, I was like, this does not seem strategic. Like, this seems like a waste of our resource. I don't need to go spend 4 days up there. I don't know what happened with this flight. I called my boss and I was like, something broke down, but like, this is not good. We need to find another way to get them, because flying our caravan doesn't make any sense. I looked at all these commercial options. I couldn't find any. And I was like, okay, like, I guess our only option is just to fly them. Like, we've committed to the flights, so we're going to fly them. And I was grumbling in my spirit. Like, I was mad. And as we're taxiing from like our hangar to customs to pick up the pastors and to load the 6 boxes of audio Bibles, I received a phone call from one of our airport managers in South Sudan, in a place called Bor. I don't know if he's a Christian. I don't know where his faith stands, but he is friendly towards us as an organization. He's kind. He's very helpful, very resourceful. And he calls me and he says, hey, do you have a minute? And I said, kind of, what's going on? And he said, my family has reached Rank, which is a border town between South Sudan and Sudan. And he said, they walked from Khartoum. And Khartoum, the capital city of Sudan, and the country of Sudan has recently broken out into civil war as well. And people fled, and they started walking. And what happened is they started walking towards Ethiopia, and Ethiopia would not open their borders. And they made a makeshift camp outside of Ethiopia, hoping they would open, and they didn't until they ran out of resources, and then they started walking to South Sudan. So if you can imagine taking refuge from Sudan into South Sudan, like, I don't know how it gets any worse than that. And then they're just walking, like, days and days and days. So he says, my family lives in Khartoum, but they walked and they've made it to rank. And he goes, can you get them? And I was like, I don't know. because that is somebody's pay grade higher than mine. and so I called my boss and I just said, hey, I got this call. Like, is there anything we can do? And he said, yeah, let's go get them. And I was like, okay. So I called the airport manager back and I said, yeah, I can come get you. And he was like, fantastic. And that day, I flew the pastors with the few audio Bibles up to northern Kenya. And then I continued my flight up north into South Sudan to where the airport manager was in Bor. And then the next day, I went up and picked up his family. And they had walked, and they had all their belongings, and brought them back down into Bor so John could help them settle into a new life in South Sudan. And it was at that moment when I realized that's why God needed me to fly that particular flight. And that's why it turns out there was 13 seats already strapped into the plane, because I needed all of them. And it turns out that's why the plane was already paid for to northern Kenya, so that we didn't have to pay for it all the way up to South Sudan. And I had the exact number of seats and the exact amount of space that I needed and the exact amount of fuel. And it was just perfect. Like, I just remember thinking, like, how foolish am I to not know the Lord's plan in such a meaningful way? And to be able to help a family in distress that were refugees, that just needed some tangible, raw assistance in a moment of extreme fragility, for me was a very encouraging thing to be part of. So, yeah, that was one of my more memorable stories. And I would offer you guys probably end up in very similar circumstances where you're frustrated with the Lord about something. And then you take a deep breath and realize why he had us in that position. And for me, that just felt really convicting. Like, I thought I knew better. and I didn't. Like, the Lord knew what was going on. And I just was so grateful for that. Before we move on to the last pictures that we have, like, I just want to express my gratitude to you as a church for praying for me. This is, I think, one of my most faithfully praying churches that I'm part of. Like, you pray consistently and regularly. You email, you ask how I'm doing, you ask if there's anything that I need. And I just feel deeply blessed. So know that I feel wildly supported by you all. And it makes my work feel lighter to know that there's a community of people that are invested in not just the work of AMER, but in my work and who I am as a person. I think that's all that I have for you. Thank you. I will find you all as I shove my face with donuts, Donut Sunday.